I want to go into a little bit more detail about some of the different key players in that, and then what happened, what went wrong because of it. And Rene Descartes is a good guy to start with. He lived from 1596 to 1650. He was a French philosopher and mathematician. He was a Roman Catholic, so he was trying to defend God's existence and things like the deity of Christ. Being a mathematician, and these guys were using the axioms of geometry, Rene Descartes thought, wouldn't it be great if we could come up with points, one point of absolute certainty, like an axiom of geometry, something that can't be doubted, cannot be doubted, because it would be a contradiction to doubt it. So it has to be true. And if we could find one point of absolute certainty, then from that we could deduce all other truth. And so I believe that really was the start of the modernist project, because it was an attempt to find all truth and to solve all our problems through human reason alone, through unaided human reason. Even the ancient Greeks couldn't have full confidence in human reason, because there was no guarantee. It's always possible our senses were deceiving us. And so they were always there was a little bit of humility that was there. Well, now with the Christian worldview, now we had the guarantee that a rational God created us in his image as rational beings and created the world in a way that makes sense, so that through reason we really could find out about the universe in which we live. So all of a sudden, man's confidence in human reason took a quantum leap forward. In Rene Descartes, we see it right in his thought. Now again, this guy's Roman Catholic. He's trying to defend traditional Christian beliefs. And so what he decided was, since I want to find that point of absolute certainty and prove everything through reason alone, why don't I use skepticism as a method to find truth? Now keep in mind, this is a Roman Catholic. This is not a skeptic. But he wanted to use skepticism as a method, so it's methodological skepticism, where he decided he would try to doubt everything until he would find a point of certainty, a point of absolute certainty that was logically necessary, that rejecting it would involve contradiction, and then from this point of certainty, all truth would be deduced. And so it wasn't like Descartes would go to bed at night thinking, gee, I haven't found that point of absolute certainty, so I'm a skeptic for another night. And the next morning I wake up, yeah, I'm still a skeptic, I haven't found... No, he'd go to bed a Roman Catholic. He was an ultra-rationalist trying to prove everything through reason alone. He wasn't really a skeptic, but he said, well, just for the sake of argument, just for the sake of finding truth, let me doubt everything until I find something I can't doubt. And so he doubted and doubted and doubted, and he looked at the world of the senses, and it's always possible that the senses are deceiving us, so he doubted that. And it just got to the point where eventually, the more he doubted, the more he became aware of the existence of himself, the doubter. So he said, the more I doubt, the more I acknowledge that I am doubting. And if I am doubting, I exist. He said, doubting is a form of thinking. And so he said, I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And so that was his starting point. And then from there, he tried to prove everything else by deducing it from that with rational certainty. Now, what he failed to realize, a contemporary, a fellow Frenchman, also a mathematician and a philosopher and a scientist, Blaise Pascal, who was about 25 years younger than him, Blaise Pascal realized immediately that Rene Descartes was going too far. Because if you try to prove everything through reason, if you think you could prove everything through reason alone and find all truth and solve all problems through reason alone, what need then is there for divine revelation from God? It makes no sense for God to reveal his word to us if we could find all truth through reason alone. So he left no room for divine revelation. So this led to the Enlightenment and eventually modernism, the focus on rationalism, where we could find natural, through reason, we could find natural causes for everything. I mean, this exploded in Descartes' face. He never knew what his views would lead to. And so eventually it was like there was no room for supernatural causes. There was no room for miracles. Now, this wasn't in Descartes' thought, but this is what Descartes' thought led to after he died. Where people said, well, we could find it. We found natural causes for earthquakes. That's not God getting ticked off, and thunder and lightning and things like that. Tidal waves, that's not God getting ticked off at us. There are natural causes for these things. I bet if we gave human reason enough time, we would find natural causes for everything. So then all of a sudden you came up with the view that this ultra-rationalism of modernism led to deism, the belief in an irrelevant God. The belief that, well, you know, we still believe in God. We still believe in God and all. However, we can't believe in miracles anymore, because we know, we have so much confidence in human reason that we'll be able to find all truth, all the answers, without appealing to God and appealing to the scriptures. So eventually it led to the belief in a God, an irrelevant God, a God who doesn't perform miracles, a God who doesn't intervene, a God who created the universe, set the laws of nature in motion, and then leaves it alone. So the laws of nature are prescriptive. They prescribe the way things have to be. Any contradiction, any violation of the laws of nature is impossible, and our reason won't allow for it. So we had this irrelevant God. Well, there's really very little practical difference between an irrelevant God, deism, and no God at all. So we can see through Enlightenment thought how we, first with belief in God, we got that confidence in human reason, but then we started focusing on the gift, reason, and forgot all about the gift giver. And so we went from Christianity to deism, like some of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, and eventually that's just going to lead to, you deists, for all practical purposes, you might as well jump in our camp, in the atheist camp, and just admit that God doesn't exist. I mean, your God has no way of revealing himself supernaturally. Maybe the natural reasons that you believe in God aren't really true as well. Deists really like the design argument. The problem was, when they looked at the design of the universe, they turned the universe into like a big clock or into a big machine. But I like what some, even modernist thinkers, have said, is that even a machine needs a machine maker. But at the same time, the universe is more like like a body than a machine. I mean, it's got certain things in common with machines, but there are other aspects that go beyond mechanical descriptions. Human beings, for instance, are not machines. We have free will and all. But whatever the case, Descartes even used the ontological argument to argue for God's existence, basically arguing that God, once you understand what God means, you must acknowledge that therefore he must exist, that by definition he must exist. But his system broke down because it's always possible that there could be an evil demon out there deceiving man. And Descartes argued, well, we know God is good, but I think that was not a rational principle that he deduced from his system. Now, the response to René Descartes comes from Blaise Pascal, his fellow contemporary Frenchman. Before I talk about him, let me just mention in passing Leibniz, philosopher, lived from 1646 to 1716. He was born just 4 years before Descartes died, and he continued the ultra-rationalistic argumentation that Descartes started. And he used his own cosmological argument from sufficient reason for God's existence. I think in itself it's a good argument. But the fact of the matter is, Leibniz was another one of those extreme rationalist, ultra-rationalist. And ultra-rationalism may seem at first to be a friend to Christianity, but in the end it is not. I'll just talk briefly about Leibniz's cosmological argument. He also used the ontological argument like Descartes. But he said that there must be an explanation for everything that exists. There are things that exist in the universe that are explained by other things, such as our continuing existence. We need air, food, water. For our beginning, we need our parents. And adding all these things that are explained, their continuing existence is explained by something else. Adding all these things in the universe together will not give an explanation for the existence of the universe. If we add all things in the universe together, and everything, all these separate things need an explanation for their existence, then you put that all together, and you still get one big thing, the universe, that needs an explanation for its existence. So Leibniz concluded there must exist some being which contains in itself the explanation for its own existence. This self-explained being, then, is the explanation for all else that exists. Otherwise, there is no explanation why anything exists at all. Now, what Leibniz is doing here is saying, and I think you could build a strong argument on that, but he's assuming, he's presupposing that the world of his mind and the world of ideas has to make sense with the world outside his mind. And I think that that's a good solid assumption if you assume the existence of God. If you don't assume the existence of God, then there's no way to know that the categories of the mind really put us in contact with the real world outside the mind. I think it's a pretty decent argument, but Leibniz, Pascal, and Descartes, the ultra-rationalistic endeavor was actually an exercise in human autonomy, an attempt for man to solve all his problems and find all truth without God. Blaise Pascal comes on the scene, brilliant guy. His major apologetic work is called The Pensées, and you can still go to Barnes & Noble and buy it to this day, as you can Descartes' work. But The Pensées is as much a refutation of Descartes' pure rationalism as it is Pascal's defense of the Christian faith. So he's not only defending the Christian faith in his own way, but he's telling you why Descartes' way doesn't work. A lot of people don't realize they try to make Pascal a fideist who believes that you have to believe apart from reason through a leap of blind faith alone. In reality, Pascal had a high view of human reason, though not as high as the ultra-rationalist. He viewed human reason, he thought human reason can work, but the problem wasn't so much human reason, the problem was humans. Human beings were fallen, so we could add 1 + 1 and come up with 3 by mistake. So sometimes we improperly use reason. Pascal would say reason works, but we make mistakes. Sometimes we misuse reason. Then he would also say, and we're also limited. We were created by God. Even before we fell, we were limited. We were created by God. In other words, you've got to put a limit on what we can learn. Pascal realized that man is more than just a rational being. He stated in his work, Pensées, the heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. So when he uses the word the heart, what he means is the intuition, things that we just know, that we know, and we don't know how we know it. We know that torturing innocent babies is evil, period. We don't need a big discussion on that. We just know it's evil. And there are many things that we know by intuition. The knowledge of the first principles. You have to start with a first principle to begin your argumentation. Pascal would say in his Pensées, If you thought Descartes was right, that you could prove all things through reason alone, well, then that means your starting point, your first principles, you would have to be able to prove that through reason alone. But then if you could prove them through reason alone, then they're not your starting points. Now your starting points are the reasons why you believed your starting point. And then these reasons are not your starting point because you have to have reasons to prove them, and it goes on, an infinite regress, reason never gets started. So you've got to start somewhere with like self-evident truths or intuition, which are really not known by reason. They're presupposed, but there might be good reasons why you presuppose them, but to argue that you got to come up with reasons for everything, you'd go back in an infinite regress. But the heart is everything, every way of knowing things, or every way of making decisions or believing things, apart from reason. So intuition, knowledge of first principles, the will, the emotions, Pascal would say we humans make most of our decisions apart from reason, and then after making our decisions, we then turn to reason to try to defend our beliefs. So he's basically saying that we don't always use reason the way we should, and more often than not, we believe something because we want to. And then we say, well, I believe this, you disagree with me, and then we search for reasons why I'm right and you're wrong. What I like about Pascal is he has a much more honest and biblical view of man. Man is a rational being, but he's not a rational being, period. Pascal, please go over here and read some of his quotes to you. Pascal, I have a chapter, an appendix on Pascal in my No Other Gods book. He's got some really, really neat quotes. Here's one where he says, Descartes, we do not think that the whole of philosophy would be worth an hour's effort. What he's saying is, you know, once you take God out of the picture and you just try to get Descartes' rationalistic thought, philosophy apart from God just isn't worth the time. He says, the heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. It is the heart which perceives God and not the reason. That is what faith is, God perceived by the heart, not by reason. Now, he's not an irrationalist, but he's saying, in the end, if you're really going to receive God, you got to receive God by your will, not just by reason. Somebody can prove to you rationally God exists, you still got to make the decision by your will to accept him. Now, Pascal has a lower view than I do on the traditional arguments for God's existence, but Pascal says this, two excesses, to exclude reason, to admit nothing but reason. So he's not an irrationalist. He says we need reason. So if you exclude reason and you try to make your decision totally without reason, that's wrong. You're going too far in one direction. But you're also going too far in the other direction if you try to admit nothing but reason. Reason's last step is the recognition that there are an infinite number of things beyond it. It is merely feeble if it does not go as far as to realize that. If natural things are beyond it, what are we to say about supernatural things? So there, we can't prove everything through reason alone. God's universe is too big, and God is far too big for man to fully grasp every bit of wisdom about God. And then he says this, if we submit everything to reason, our religion will be left with nothing mysterious or supernatural. He's basically saying, if we can prove everything through reason alone, there's no need for divine revelation. If we can figure everything out, find natural causes for everything, there's no place for the supernatural. In the end, what he's basically saying is, if you deify reason, make an idol out of reason, in the end, there's no room for God. And I think it's more than a coincidence that René Descartes was a Frenchman, and the French Revolution was built on the idea of human reason alone, with the statue to Sophia, the goddess of wisdom, and why the French Revolution failed so miserably and led to all the bloodshed that it led to. Let me see if I can get a quote here on... here's what he says too. Man is only a reed, the weakest in nature, but he is a thinking reed. So he acknowledges human reason there. Then he says, there's no need for the whole universe to take up arms to crush him. A vapor, a drop of water is enough to kill him. But even if the universe were to crush him, man would still be nobler than his slayer because he knows that he is dying and the advantage the universe has over him. The universe knows none of this. Thus all our dignity consists in thought. Yeah, here he's saying, what gives us dignity, one of the key reasons why we're created in God's image is because of reason. So he's not an irrationalist, he's not an anti-rationalist, but he understands that we humans are fallen and limited, so the idea that we could take our reasoning ability and find all truth and solve all our problems goes way beyond what God intended reason to do. I like what Pascal says about the human condition. So what Pascal does then is he's opposed to traditional arguments for God's existence. And at one, a few points, he acknowledges the possibility maybe traditional arguments for God work. But even if they work, the average person isn't going to be able to follow your line of reasoning. And then the few that will follow your line of reasoning and you convince them that God exists, if they don't embrace God with their will, the next day they forget the line of the complex line of reasoning, and they go back to being an atheist. And then Pascal argued, even if they worked and you convince the guy God exists, he's still far from God's kingdom because he hasn't accepted Christ. So Pascal really doesn't have spend much time with traditional arguments for God's existence. So what he does is he says, well, what's important to man? Does man like philosophical arguments and stuff like that? No. Well, what does a man like? Well, man likes himself. So he says, well, let's start with man. Let's start with psychology and see what happens after the study of the self. He points out the paradox of man. Man is both wretched and great. Man is great because he's this thinking being. The entire universe does not think, cannot think. So there's a sense where one individual human being is greater than all the non-human aspects of the universe. So man is great, but he's also wretched. We all hear horror stories of a grandson pouring gasoline on his grandmother and setting her on fire and, you know, killing her like that, and all kinds of horror stories of, you know, now we have mothers who will abort their children and their unborn children and all, and the animal kingdom does not even come close to the wretchedness that human beings are able to achieve. You show me the most bloodthirsty pit bull out there, and he'll never come close on the wretchedness chart with an Adolf Hitler or a Joseph Stalin. So man is both great and wretched, and part of his greatness is that he's a dispossessed king. It's not like he's just poor. He's poor, but he knows that deep down inside, he knows he used to be rich. So it's like a king who's been knocked off his throne. So then he talks about the human condition. Here's what he says. Imagine a number of men in chains, all under sentence of death, some of whom are each day butchered in the sight of the others. Those remaining see their own condition and that of their fellows, and looking at each other with grief and despair, await their turn. This is an image of the human condition. He says, we're all in line waiting to die. We know we're going to die, yet we don't want to face it. He says this, it is absurd of us to rely on the company of our fellows, as wretched and helpless as we are. They will not help us. We shall die alone. He says further, the last act is bloody, however fine the rest of the play. They throw earth over your head, and it is finished forever. He basically says, Pascal says, look, man's wretched and great. He's got to try to solve that dilemma. The human condition, we're all on a one-way street to death. And so how does man respond to this hopeless condition? Pascal says, well, the way he responds when he goes out dancing. What he's saying is he uses the term diversion. Well, it could be dancing like he talks about, or it could be sports, it could be your career. But we know we're going to die. Pascal talks about us running full speed towards the edge of a cliff and with our hand over our face or blindfold over our eyes so we don't see what we know is coming up. And we can go to someone else's funeral and lie to ourselves and say, they'll never be my funeral. That's not for me. That's for everybody else. That's not for me. Well, you put off this death issue. That's like when you see these atheists driving around in cars with the Darwin fish, and they got all this confidence. They're all pumped up because after we die, we cease to exist. That's a diversion. The guy is diverting his attention from his own death. Because of death, we can divert our attention, just set up little diversions and all. Or we can have in total indifference, just a lack of interest in the eternal things. That itself is a diversion. Just get caught up in some temporal thing, something of temporary worth. Or we could deceive ourselves and deny that we're going to die and argue along those lines. What Pascal says is this. The human condition is death. You can sum it all up with these. it's death. If you refuse to face death, you're going to divert your attention, diversions. But if you face death without God, you're going to despair. And Pascal says the only way to find deliverance is to seek God with all your heart. Blaise Pascal does not argue, his wager argument, we'll come up to that in just a few minutes, he's not arguing that God exists. He's arguing that the wise man will hope that God exists and will seek for God with all his heart. We don't know for sure where Pascal would put the argument in. Most people believe he would put it in somewhere near the end of his argumentation. I believe it would appear somewhere in the closer to the beginning, maybe at the end of the first one-third of the book. And we don't know. He died. He had all these notes, but he never put it into, never completed his book. Died at the age of 39. So we don't know for sure the order he would have things. But when you look at his view of reason, it makes sense that his wager argument for God's existence would be placed closer to the end of the book. The reason being, he's saying, look, we can use reason, but we're so sinful, we never use reason in an unbiased way. So the question is, are you going to be biased for God or against God? And then Pascal argues that the wise man will always be biased for God. After his wager argument, then he would use historical evidences for Christianity, fulfilled prophecies as evidence that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, the miraculous history and survival of the Jewish race, and then the miracles and the resurrection of Christ. He even argues against the apostles stealing the body, that these guys were able to keep a secret and die for that secret, knowing they were lying through their teeth, be willing to die horrible deaths when all they had to do was admit that Jesus really didn't rise from the dead and they would have been set free. Pascal says, no, it's clear that Jesus is who he claimed to be, performed miracles, rose from the dead, fulfilled prophecies, and he uses that as evidence for Christianity. Now, Pascal's wager, again, it's not an attempt to prove God's existence. It's a plea for people to seek God and desire that he exists. Because he believes, first off, he believes Jeremiah 17:9, that the heart is deceitful above all things. Who can know it? So we can't even trust our use of human reason, because we can't trust ourselves. But he says that he understands Jeremiah 29:13, if you seek God with all your heart, you will find him. So it's Pascal's job not to prove to you that God exists, but to get you to seek God's existence, to seek God with all your heart. His wager argument is not an attempt to prove God's existence, then it's a plea for people to seek God and desire that he exists, because those who seek him will find him. The choices, he says, are this. Now, Blaise Pascal was not a gambler. Yet, Blaise Pascal is the foremost authority in the history of philosophy on what a good wager is. He's the guy who wrote the laws of probability. So even though he wasn't a gambler, he could tell you, based on the laws of probability, what a good wager is. And he says, look, if you wager on God, if you wager your life that God exists, in other words, if you seek for God and hoping to find him, if you live as if God exists, okay, if you wager your life on God, if he exists, you win. Well, what do you win? You win eternal life. You win eternity. Yeah, but what if you lose? If he doesn't exist and you wagered on God, you lose absolutely nothing. And if we lose, the atheist cannot tell us. If you're in a car with an atheist, you die in a car wreck, a minute after both of you die, the atheist can't look to eternity and say, see, I told you I was right. I won. There's no joy in that victory, because the atheist wins absolutely nothing, and the Christian loses absolutely nothing if God does not exist. Now, if you wager against God, and if you win, you win nothing. If God doesn't exist, there's no life after death. Even if you win absolutely nothing. However, if you wager against God and he does exist, you lose eternity. You lose everything. And so Pascal said that the wise man will wager his life on God, will wager his life that God exists. He has nothing to lose and everything to gain. Therefore, he's going to wager his life on God. Now, Pascal's assessment is this. There are only two classes of people who can be called reasonable. Those who serve God with all their heart because they know Him, and those who seek Him with all their heart because they do not know Him. See what he's saying there? What he's saying is, because the possibility of so much to win and no possibility of loss, the wise man is always going to seek for God if he doesn't know Him, and if he's found God, he's going to serve Him with all his heart. So those two types of guys, those who seek God and those who serve Him, those are called wise men. The guy who doesn't seek for God, the atheist, cannot be called wise in any sense of the term. Now, hear me out on this. This is how powerful Pascal's wager argument is. I believe it was Peter Creel. I'm not sure the name of the philosopher. It's been so long since I read his paper. But he basically argued that Pascal's argument works. Pascal seems to imply, look, it's an either or. It's a 50-50 thing. Either God exists or He doesn't. But Pascal's not dealing with the evidence. Creel says that even if there's only a 1% chance that God exists, the wise man is still going to wager his life on God. He's still going to seek Him until he finds Him, and then once he finds Him, he's going to serve Him. And the reason why he's saying it is, supposing your child is lost in the woods, and the sheriff's department is trying to search for your child, and after 2 days they can't find your child, and then they come up to you and your wife, and they say, look, there's only a 1% chance that your child is still alive. Would it be all right if we gave up the search? What are you going to tell them? It's like you got so much to gain by continuing the search, even with 1% chance. If you find that your child and your child's still alive, you've got everything to gain and nothing to lose by just spending another day searching. But if you give up the search, if that 1% chance was true, and your child was alive, you just signed the death certificate of your child. So even if there's just 1% chance that God exists, the wise man is still going to seek Him. But this idea that atheists, with their arrogance, boldly, you know, proclaim with laughter and with cheering that they believe that God doesn't exist, so they put bumper stickers on their car and stuff, that's a joke. It's like the Apostle Paul said, you know, if the dead are not raised, there's no life after death, we're not going to be judged. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So that's a little background on Blaise Pascal. His warning to Rene Descartes was pretty much this. Descartes' attempt to prove Christianity through reason alone will backfire. It will become the biggest enemy Christianity has ever seen to this point in history. He basically predicted the coming of modernism, that if we can prove everything through reason alone, there will be no place for divine revelation. And that's exactly what the ultra-rationalist position did. And the ultra-rationalist position, by the way, gave way to two branches. One was trying to find all truth through reason alone. The other was trying to find all truth through the empiricism, through empirical evidence, through the five senses alone. And either way, you ended up with modernism failed. And rationalists, the best they could do is find the laws of logic and mathematical principles, but they really couldn't find anything in the physical world with rational certainty, logical necessity. Those who just chose the world of the senses, they couldn't even... David Hume became a skeptic and said, we can't even prove through the five senses the law of causality. So all we could say is, if somebody punches somebody else in the nose and it causes pain, we can't really say, well, a punch to the face causes pain. All we can say is that after a punch to the face, the next thing that follows is pain. Because cause and effect isn't something we experience, it's something our minds read onto it. So if you're an empiricist, you end up with skepticism. One other Christian thinker I want to mention here before I get to the philosophers who attacked traditional apologetics. And the atheist likes to think that, you know, Immanuel Kant and Hegel were their heroes, and David Hume, these guys were their heroes. In actuality, those guys all believed in the existence of some type of God. So there are very few heroes for atheism. And Friedrich Nietzsche, who died mad, there's one. He was a real atheist. Sigmund Freud, who had weird views about sexuality, there's another. But most of the guys that they claim as the heroes, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, David Hume, Immanuel Kant, all these guys believe in the existence of some type of God. So, whatever the case, William Paley used his watchmaker argument for God's existence. William Paley reasoned that if you went into the wilderness and you found a watch, even if you didn't know, if you never saw a watch before, you would see the complexity and the design and the order in the watch, and you would conclude it had to have a watchmaker. Okay? But then William Paley said, yeah, but when you look at the human eye, it's much more complex and designed and orderly than a watch. Therefore, for us to conclude that the human eye got here by chance is ludicrous. By the way, people say, yeah, oh, he finds a watch and says it's got to have a watchmaker. Hey, archaeologists do that when they find arrowheads. And I don't know if you noticed, but an arrowhead is no way, not even close to the complexity and the design and the order of a watch. Yet if atheist archaeologists can find an arrowhead and say, therefore, intelligent designer, then surely they should be able to say that with a watch, with a human eye. And then what about an amoeba? A single-celled animal has enough genetic information in its DNA alone to fill 1,000 complete sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, each complete set of Encyclopedia Britannica is 30 volumes. So that's 30,000 volumes. That's a very large library. That's the amount of information you get in a single-celled animal. Now, by the time you get to a human brain, the most complex thing that's out there in our universe that we know of, you're talking way, way beyond that. For evolutionists to act like, well, this big random explosion, the Big Bang, produced and is continuing to produce all the order and complexity found in the universe and all the future order and complexity, that's baloney. Every explosion, random explosion we've ever examined has taken things from a state of order to a state of disorder and chaos, not the other way around. If you have a TV that also plays video cassettes and you blow it up, you blew it up, now it plays DVDs as well. It goes from a state of order to a state of disorder. So that's not a scientific statement. We're being lied to when people say it is. William Paley, a lot of people think David Hume refuted him, when in reality, William Paley uses the same terminology that Hume used. It seems that Paley was responding to Hume and offering a refutation. By the way, David Hume did not defeat the teleological argument, the argument for God from design. That was his favorite argument for God. However, David Hume was a deist, so he believed in a God that doesn't perform miracles, but he believed the teleological argument was the best argument out there. It didn't prove its conclusion with logical necessity. Then again, he was an empiricist. He didn't believe in that you could find that about the physical world. So contrary to popular belief, David Hume did not refute God. A lot of these guys didn't like the traditional arguments, but that doesn't make them atheists. Atheists are too quick to claim people as their own when they're not, and then to disclaim people who are their own, like atheists to communists who killed over 100 million people in the past century alone. Atheists will say, well, they're a different kind of atheist. No, they agree with the atheistic evolution. They agree that there's no God. They believe there's no morality. They believe there's no absolute truth. The same kind of atheist you are. Maybe you don't like their form of government. You claim you don't, but you're a socialist yourself. Most atheists would be in the socialist camp. Now, Anthony Flew was the world's leading agnostic, did not believe that God existed. Now, through debates with William Lane Craig and Gary Habermas, my old professor, now he's at least a deist. He believes in the existence of a non-miracle working God. And it was because of the design argument. So I think William Paley's design argument is making a big comeback, especially with the anthropic principle, all the design and order in the universe that makes the earth, gives the earth the ability to sustain human life there's more, that's why the whole intelligent design movement is making so many waves at this point. And so I think that there's tremendous strength in the traditional teleological argument.